All right, let's make sure you are ready to continue on here and deal with this matter of testing, particularly with regard to the issue of phase two faith. As a believer has his faith tested, he's either going to rise to the occasion or he will fail. He will collapse and run with the sin nature, possibly even worse, demonic viewpoint, other things. Or he's going to succeed. And of course, the goal is to succeed. So having read those verses there, 1 Peter here, 1, 6, and 7. In this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been distressed by various trials. So that the purpose of these trials is the proving of your faith. These are what test us. And being more precious than gold, which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. Well, the phrase "for a little while" draws attention to the relative brevity of suffering in comparison to the eternal potential for the positive believer. This is one of the things that believers lose sight of, is that we're in time. I mean, we recognize what time is. It's the linear component, tick, 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 seconds make minutes, minutes make hours, hours make days, and on and on. But time seems to be long, depending upon certain things. It seems to go slower at certain times. There's a component to time that, at least in the terms of our perception of time and its passing, if you're doing something enjoyable, time goes by pretty quick. You don't notice it as much. If you're doing something filled with drudgery and all of that, time can seem to drag on forever. But the fact is here, for a little while, stresses this matter of that our testing has an end. This is in result, of course, this is in conjunction with the matter of the phase two helmet of salvation. The helmet of salvation is designed to protect your thinking. And the helmet refers to phase three salvation, not phase one. And so it's the promise of phase three salvation that lets the believer know, number one, this is not permanent. This testing has an end to it. However long it is, it's not eternal. It will end. That at any test you're under, whatever it is, you can console yourself with the fact this will be over eventually, whenever it is. Now, obviously, the testing and certain things, depending upon some tests are short-lived. Some take a long, long time. Some may last your entire life. But the fact is, what we do know is even if it lasts our entire life, at some point we're going to die. And it's over. And so when we're under testing, of course, it seems like it's longer than it is when things aren't pleasant. But the reality is, again, here, this is in comparison, the short time. And he talks about this. He makes this kind of comparison too, I think, and let me just double check here, but I think he does in 1 Corinthians 4. Maybe it's 2 Corinthians. I don't remember which, but momentary light affliction. He makes it in 2 Corinthians 4. Momentary light affliction is contrasted with eternal glory. The two are designed, and they're put side by side here so that one can see the comparison. And there is no comparison, of course, when one considers it logically. There's no comparison between a momentary affliction and an eternal glory. One is like that, as it were. And the psalmist, I believe, talks about the fact that our lives are just like a watch in the night and they're over with. Then that's just the way they go. Well, B. Peter is not saying that phase two suffering is near the end or of brief or temporal duration. He is saying that the present ordeals are insignificant as compared to the blessings of the eternal future. But again, what are you thinking about? That's going to determine how this goes. If you're not rigorously dealing with your own sin nature and keeping your mind where it's supposed to be, you will not be successful. But this is true of anything. I mean, can you imagine? You know, do you have to tell the brain surgeon, now, doctor, you've really got to focus. This is kind of important. I mean, do you think maybe we should turn off Tom and Jerry or The Simpsons while we're doing the surgery? Maybe you don't need that distraction. No, hopefully you wouldn't have to tell a brain surgeon that. Well, you shouldn't have to tell believers because they should know that these things are temporal. They're brief. So he is saying that the present ordeals are insignificant when compared to the eternal future. Here, Romans 8:18. For I consider the sufferings of this present time. Now, why do believers crash spiritually? Because they get off on the fact and they start feeling sorry for themselves that my sufferings are worse than everybody's. Nobody's been through this but me. I'm the only one who knows how hard it is. Well, first, it's nonsense, because one of the things Peter says is knowing this, that the same things we are suffering are being accomplished among, the same sufferings are being accomplished among your brothers. So this idea that I'm tired of running the fight and nobody knows how hard it's been and how long I've run, well, we could all say that. You know, it isn't as though most of us haven't been at this for in excess of 25, 30 years. We've been at it for quite a while. So why do some people quit or soul faint? And why do others keep running? And these are just choices. These are just mental decisions that people make, and bad mental decisions lead to bad outcomes. And bad mental decisions often come as a result of no spiritual food. You're feeding off the sin nature. You're feeding off the cosmos around you. Any demonic influence. And you wonder why believers end up in messes. Well, I can tell you why. They have given up the fight mentally. And until they decide to fight, there isn't anything you can do for them. Pray for them, I suppose. Pray that they'll fight, but you can't make them. You know? If they don't want to do it, they're not going to do it. This is where you have to allow for volition, and sadly, in a serious situation here. I consider the sufferings of this present time are not worthy. You can't put them in the same equation. They can't be compared, as he would say here. They're not worthy to be compared, whatever they are. But when we're in it, oh, they're worthy. You bet your something they're worthy. Of course they are. That's where we get off on our self-pity party and how bad it is and how we're the only ones suffering and all that. But other believers are going through the same stuff or worse. And self-pity is not very becoming upon anybody, certainly not on a positive believer. That's a real issue, in fact. Not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed to us. But we see that's a problem too. Never seen that glory, can't show it to you, can't give you an idea so that you might say, well, that would motivate me. Because then, how could I? Well, number one, you wouldn't need faith if you could see it, right? You wouldn't have to walk by faith. Now, that would eliminate all of that. You could walk by sight. I've seen the glory. It is worth it. But that's the thing. It's glory that we haven't seen. We can't even fathom. And to keep fighting the fight. And every day, it's a challenge. Just keep putting one foot in front of another. I know what it's like out there. I struggle with the same things you do. So, the fact is, having priorities straight does help make this better. But one of the things I've learned very early, not early on, but I've learned it over the course of my Christian life, and that is when you start letting your mind go and you start feeling sorry for yourself, you better pull it in quick or you likely will crash and burn. Because that can't go on for very long before you start making really stupid decisions. And entertaining this stuff in your mind and blowing things up and refusing to deal with other people, this does not serve the believer at all. This will result in catastrophe if extended. I mean, I've seen it happen before multitudes of times. And I did have it in there, I suppose, 2 Corinthians 4:17 there, the one we just looked at. C, the first class condition, if necessary, which is assumed as true, indicates that suffering, testing, and temptation are not viewed as optional in the Christian way of life. So what is it? And another reason, you know, why do people get into this? All of this depression and feeling sorry for themselves and all this. I'll tell you why, because they got their eyes on themselves. They don't care about other believers. They've lost sight of certain things. It's all about them. I, me, mine. And that's what gets believers into all kinds of trouble. And so maybe believers think, well, I've been running the Christian life here now. I've been doing this for 15, 20, 25, 30, 35 years. Things should be going better for me now. And maybe certain believers don't like the way God's handled their niche. What are you going to do? I'll tell you what, take it up with God. Call him a few filthy names, threaten him, and see how that works out. I've tried all that, by the way, and it doesn't work. I will here testify that that doesn't work. That you have to rigorously, and it's not easy. And at some point, the mind is going to crack if you don't get on top of it. And once your mind cracks, you're probably done. And the mind is a terrible thing. And but more than that, some of you are still awake. But more than that, it's more fragile than people imagine. The mind is a fragile thing. And that's why the helmet of salvation. We know this is going to be over. I don't have to fight this fight forever. That protects my mind from giving in and throwing in the towel, giving up. So, again, this is an option. You're going to be tested. It's going to be hard. Here's your encouragement today. It's going to get worse. However bad it's been, it'll probably get worse. And, I'm not saying that tongue-in-cheek. It probably will. That's what's sad. And if you're not on top of it now, what are you going to do when it gets worse? I think one of those passages, and I think it was in the U.S. in Prophecy. I can't remember if it was in that group or if I just read it elsewhere, but one of those Old Testament prophecies said, if you have trouble running in the open plain, what are you going to do when you get caught in the thicket of the Jordan? And if you can't walk the Christian life when things are going relatively well, what are you going to do when all hell breaks loose? If you aren't on a day-to-day basis staying on top of this stuff, you will become a casualty. It's just that true. It's just that's a fact. And that's what we're trying to avoid. Is watching. I've seen enough people crash and burn. My Lupe list is 10 times longer than my prayer list, and it keeps growing. My prayer list doesn't seem to keep growing. My Lupe list does. So the reality is we've seen it all too often. But believers they have to fight this fight themselves. Nobody can fight it for them. I can't fight it for you. You can't fight it for me. When I'm ready to throw in the towel, I've got to get through that. So the first class is necessary. Again, this isn't optional. It's going to happen. Inure yourself to it. And a matter of fact, rather than inure yourself to it, I think later on Peter says, arm yourself with this idea when you're facing this testing and all of that. Yeah, 1 Peter 4:1. Since Christ has suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves also with the same purpose. This is to equip yourself as a part of your warfare, your fight. Is the mental attitude that I'm going to suffer and I don't care. At certain points, you have to have that attitude if you're going to make it. Because there is going to be suffering. And the suffering isn't going to stop at some point. I mean, that'd be nice if I could tell you, well, you suffer for however long, a week, a month, a year, and it'll all be over with. But it won't be. Because it can't be over with because we got a cosmic system engineered by Satan and animated by him. We got an enemy of Satan and the demons. They aren't going to go away. And the old sin nature isn't going to change. So you think, well, if I could just, if I can grow to a certain point, I'll just be successful and I will be above all this. Sure you will. Let me know what that point is when you get to it, would you? Because I'd like to get there. But unfortunately, that's not the reality. It's a fight. And the fights come and go. I recognize intensity varies. Some days it's a real hard fight. Other days it's not that hard. Yesterday I got up and I knew I had to do several things. I had to got some stuff ordered I had to take care of. And then I had to go pick it up later. And I had to get the lawn cut and do all that stuff. And I thought, okay, I know what I got to do. So I armed myself with these purposes. Okay, I'm going to go get this done. And, I sailed through it, got it all done. Guess what? Wasn't a very difficult day at all. It wasn't fun mowing the lawn, but, you know, what can you do? I mean, in Florida in summer. And it's gotten to where now I really have to cut my lawn probably about every fifth or sixth day. I can't even let it go all week now because of the nature of it. Hopefully it'll quit raining for a little bit. Those are physical, easy things you have to do. You have to cut the grass. You have to go to the store. You have to make, you know, order stuff that you got to take care of. But then I have to, I'm like, okay, well, I need to put in 4 or 5 hours a day in a study. Ugh. 4 or 5 hours in a study. I can't get them to show up 4 or 5 hours a week. I got to put it in a day? Well, that seems oppressive and unfair. But that's just the way it is. And so I can get maladjusted to that and have. And said, I don't want to do it. But you have to fight through it. If you don't fight through it, you're going to have these highs and lows in your Christian life. It'd be great if it was all just a nice, smooth, upward ride. But that isn't the way we grow, and that isn't the reality of it. You'll have ups and downs. And if you don't fight through the low spots, there's not going to be anybody to save you. You have to fight through them. You don't let the highs get you too high, and don't let the lows get you too low, because you're going to have both. And some people, they get to a high, and, oh, it's all wonderful and all that. You see them the next week, and they're, you know, down in the dumps and can't talk. Well, don't let the highs get you too high. There are great experiences in the Christian life. Well, the verb lupeo, distressed, to have sorrow of some sort mentally, is used in the active sense of causing severe emotional or mental distress to another. In a passive sense, it means to experience sorrow, vexation, distress, or grief. And this deals with the mental and emotional stress that one experiences when one's faith is tested. These are called tests for a reason. Number one, they're hard. We say they're hard, but are they hard? Yeah, do you remember when you went to school and you knew you had a test coming? Was the test hard? I bet the nature of the test and your perception of it was directly proportional to the degree to which you were prepared or unprepared. Am I right? If you studied and you were prepared for the test and you knew the material, the test wasn't hard. But if you didn't study and you didn't know the material and you weren't prepared, you say, well, that test was hard. So people flunked it. Well, physically in school, the same thing's true here. It kind of depends on how prepared we are. You're not praying. You're not socializing with other believers. You don't fellowship with positive volition. You're not in Bible class. You're not prepared. I can tell you right now you're not prepared. This will destroy you under those circumstances. And what are you going to do about it, though? You're the only one that can fight through this. I'm the only one that can fight my fight. We can't fight it for each other. We can pray for each other, which we should. But we can't fight it for each other. 2 Corinthians here, 1:8. For we do not want you to be unaware, brother. In other words, I want you to be keenly aware of this, is what he means. He's just saying it in a nicer way. But I want you to understand something here. Of our affliction which came to us in Asia, that we were burdened excessively, beyond our strength, so that we despaired even of life. Paul literally went through a period here, and those with him, he says we, so he's got his little whatever entourage was with him at the time. And they got to the point, they were so concerned for their own physical well-being that they weren't sure they were going to live another day. That something was going to take them out. Probably persecution. Probably attacks. And they wanted to, you know, and there were a lot of people that wanted to kill Paul. And a lot of times all you had to do to meet, it was meet Paul and you'd want to kill him. He doesn't appear to have, you know, he engendered either, seems to me, great loyalty or great hostility from people. Now, I'm not saying there weren't some people out there who would say, I can take him or leave him. But I don't think with Paul that was the case much. You either recognized what he was doing and who he was and supported that and appreciated it and all that, or you didn't. And if you didn't, well, you probably didn't like Paul at all. And there are a bunch of people that wanted to kill him for a bunch of reasons. The unbelievers there in Ephesus, they wanted to kill him because he was costing them money. The shrines business was suffering. So Demetrius wanted to get the silversmiths together and take Paul out. And some people there, the Asiarchs they're called, some leaders who somehow had some regard for Paul, wouldn't let him go into the theater there at Ephesus because they were going to tear him limb from limb. And when he got to Jerusalem there in Acts, later on, they were going to tear him limb from limb, except the Roman soldier intervened, the centurion. And then they laid in wait and they formed this plot. They were going to murder him on the way as they took him up to Caesarea Philippi. And they were going to kill him then. And so lots of people had lots of reasons for wanting Paul dead. The Judaizers didn't like him at all. And the hardcore Judaizers, he took them on big time, so they really didn't like him. So he said, we had the sentence of death. In other words, we weren't sure we were going to make it another day. And because of the persecution and the testing and all we were under. And we had a hard time even taking this or dealing with it. So when you're facing these mental tests, number one, know that first, other believers have faced this. Paul has faced it. 2 Corinthians is a pretty good book in that it deals a lot with this matter of the testing and the comfort and all of that comes with it. If you're looking for it. See, some people just sit around and feel sorry for themselves and they say, well, I never get any comfort. Do you look for it? Are you aware of it at all? Do you seek any comfort out or do you just sit there and feel sorry for yourself? And we've all done it. I've done it. I'll be the first to tell you. I've done it. Just sat there and felt sorry for myself. And it served me. It really did. It made me a better believer. Oh, no. Nope. Got me into trouble. God didn't really care for that. And really, realistically, and of course, this is the kind of thing that go through my mind when I'm facing these kind of things. Sitting there whining about how difficult it is, how nobody knows and all this. I'm suffering. Have you suffered more than my son? Probably not. That always slows me down. What's your thinking on that? But no, people don't want to focus on Jesus. See, what did he tell them when you're running this race? Focusing our attention on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. People are not occupied with Christ. Why? Because they're not occupied with doctrine. And if you're not occupied with doctrine, you're not occupied with Christ. Because the two go hand in hand. And so, people run around and say they love Jesus, but they don't know anything about the Bible. They've got some emotional fuzzy, is about all they have. And they think that's going to constitute love. First, that's not even real love. I feel something. I think it's heartburn or love. I'm just not sure which. After I eat that pizza, I don't know. So here, again, we're going to have grief. You're going to have sorrow. It's going to be difficult. And to act like it shouldn't be or wouldn't be or isn't going to be is just delusional. We've got a scriptures that have warned us that this is going to happen. And in the last days, who's going to survive it? How many are actually going to survive it and pay the price to be what a local church is supposed to be? And that is a local church is no better or worse than the sum total of its members. So what people are or aren't reflects what this church is or isn't at a certain level. At some level. And that's the nature of the body, though. But see, people, they've got other priorities. I don't have to be in a physical body. I can listen online. I don't have to apply towards other believers. I can get all my doctrine elsewhere. Yeah, well, guess what? You're not applying any of that doctrine you're getting elsewhere. You're blowing off certain things, pretty evident. The assembly together, for instance, that's kind of important. All those people sitting out there listening on tapes, and this has been encouraged over the years by doctrinal pastors, and I have flat out discouraged this. I have taken the complete opposite tack. There's a little bitty part of me that just wants to say, take everything off the internet. If they're not here and don't get it face to face, too damn bad. Because if they don't want to pay the price to get here, then tough. We're not going to make it easy. Now, we still continue to provide it in grace. And that's exactly what it is. It's grace. It's not because we have any obligation to provide doctrine for people that won't assemble. I don't see anything in it I've ever read in the New Testament that says, oh, by the way, if they don't show up, do something else. If they don't assemble, do something else for them. Well, we're not. We're not going to pull it. But there's a little part of me that wants to. There's a little part of me that's wanted to do this since the internet became an issue. And tapes and all that. People want to live on tapes and blow off what it is they're learning in the tapes. What's the point of that? If it's not being worked out and applied in your life, in the realm of the church, in the realm of the body of Christ, what doctrine have you got? Exactly. Because all I read in the Bible tells me that this is a body, this is a single entity, we're not free to just do what we feel like because we're bodily parts. The body depends on the bodily parts all showing up every morning when you get out of bed. Well, my feet decided not to work today. They're taking the day off. Well, you're going to have trouble walking on those ankles, let me warn you. My teeth decided they're not going today. Well, you're not going to eat much, and soup, whatever you can gum. But we think, well, that's ludicrous. Your body can't do that. Yes, it can't. That's true, it can't. And neither is the spiritual body to be doing that. So E here, this deals with the mental and emotional stress that one experiences when one's faith is tested. 2 Corinthians 1:8, we just read that one there. 1 Thessalonians 4:13. Paul experienced this, and sometimes maybe it's a little lost, but when he uses words like we were burdened beyond our ability to handle it, that we despaired even of life. This is some pretty heavy mental testing where Paul's ready to, or is thinking he's going to die. That's pretty hard. 1 Thessalonians here, 4:13, here in the context of the rapture, here in the context of losing a believer, losing someone, a loved one to death. We don't want you to be uninformed, brothers, about those who are asleep. In other words, those who have died. This is Paul's language he uses. Paul has two different words for sleep that he uses, and koimao here. This is the one he uses as a euphemism for physical death. He consistently uses it this way. So that you will not grieve as do the rest. So if you have a loved one die, you're going to feel sad. I hate to break it to you, but it'll happen. And it's going to be painful and difficult. But what we're saying is not that you don't grieve, but that you don't grieve like those without doctrine. That's the rest, the unbelievers out there who have no hope. Because for them, when somebody dies, it's all over. It truly is, whether they want to acknowledge it or admit it or not. And the more I kind of been paying attention a little more sometimes as I flip around and watch TV, and I listen to people talk about life or life after death and all. Of course, they never mention God, but I think there's something out there. Well, what do you think it is? Well, they don't really have any hope because we know what it is. We have actual hope, a living hope. We have a living Savior. They don't. So when they die, that's the last time they're ever going to see the person. For us, no. We have hope. We know that we'll see them again. That we'll be reunited in heaven forever with them. We're not going to lose them. So that's why we don't grieve the way they grieve. Number one, the test isn't even the same in that sense. The believer has the doctrine to know, hey, this isn't over. This isn't the end. Death isn't the end. But it will still be a pressure on you. And people say, well, you shouldn't cry when somebody dies. How do you know what people should do? You're going to cry. You're going to have times of sadness and all that. That's fine. That doesn't. Sadness and tears are sometimes wash away the sorrow in the soul. They're certainly expressing it. And so you'll be sad. Okay. Point F now, the purpose or result clause, which is introduced by Hina, asserts that the process of testing will demonstrate the genuine nature of faith to faith. As believers apply the doctrine to that test, the test has to be addressed. Peter is not questioning the genuine nature of their phase one faith. Now, just because you're tested, we're not saying you're not saved. In fact, your phase one faith demonstrates the fact that you're being tested kind of points to phase one faith. That's an issue. Rather, he is informing them that the quality of their phase two faith will be tested by these trials. And then we'll find out, well, see, and I've told you before, I've said this from day one, the very start of the ministry, but none of you were here then, but Linda was. She's the only one. But at the very start, I said, before this is all over, everybody's feet are going to be put to the fire. Everybody is going to be revealed for what they are. And where do you want to be in all of this? Do you not want to be on the side of the positive believers, however few of them there may be, who are willing to pay the price and do what they're supposed to be doing? Or do you want to be among those who are throwing their crown away, essentially, at the last minute? Well, a horrible time to do it. I mean, literally, these are people who've run a marathon. The finish line is in sight. They can see it. And then they quit running and just stop. And they may not finish. But they can see the finish line and will not run. Well, what can you do for somebody like that? That's very difficult. So the quality of their phase two faith is going to be tested. Do you believe the doctrine? You can say you believe doctrine all day long. Testing proves whether you do or not. Again, James says talk is cheap. John says that in 1 John. Talk is cheap. He indicates that the phase two faith of the believer is viewed by God as something that is exceedingly valuable. I have to look at this because Pete told me on break that this actually refers to the testing that is valuable. So more valuable. Yeah, it certainly matches up with Dokimon there, that's for sure. So, okay, but anyway, if the testing is what's valuable, then how should we view our testing? If Peter is here saying this, which it looks like to me he is, if he's saying the testing is valuable, that's not how I look at my testing. How about you? You say, oh, goody. Here's another chance to show my faith and apply. Or do I look at the testing and say, ah, what's wrong with God? Doesn't he know I don't need this today? You know. And so he makes these outlandish statements. We've seen Paul in his outlandish statements in Romans. We exult in our tribulations. What? No, we don't. Like hell. Romans 5:3. We exult. We're jumping up and down happy about our pressures. Are we? I don't feel like I am sometimes. No, but we have to recognize that this is a part of it. And you may say, well, you know, I've heard all this before. Yeah, but it's under the pressure of the testing you got to bring this up. It's when you're under it. It's that moment when you're fighting the fight. And I know for a fact that is a challenge. I'd like to say, well, it'll be easy. Just think of the doctrine. It'll all fall in place for you. It won't. And if the demons are working on you, which no doubt they are, I mean, if you're a positive believer, I got to believe they don't take much time off. If they're working on you, they're not going to just give up and go away because you say, well, I'm going to apply doctrine. Well, that's fine. We'll quit. We won't afflict you anymore. No, it doesn't work that way. They may just redouble their efforts once they see you resisting them. So we exult in our tribulations, knowing that tribulation, pressure, testing brings about patience. It does. It brings about frustration to me. And too often that's how we react to it. But in that moment, and again, this is very difficult. Somebody makes you mad. In that split second, you have a quick choice to make. And you're either going to get mad, run with it, or you're going to say, you know what? That's anger. That's wrong. I'm not going to do it. And I reject it. And you say, well, but then everything will be fine once you pass the test. No, you'll be tempted again. Mm-hmm. I mean, how many times do you get tempted with anger? Once you give in to it, isn't it hard to get over with and get away from it? Once you put that in charge of your life and start letting it call the shots, anger. And I pick that thing because it's pretty common. I mean, most everybody deals with anger, I think, at some level. Some people have it as a primary trend. That's one of the ones I have to deal with a lot. But the fact is, I find myself thinking, you know what? In that moment, I've got to start thinking better. Because once you give into it and start catering to the sin nature or falling to the demonic attacks and all of that, it just is easier to go that way. It just becomes easier to not fight. It doesn't make you any more happy, though, by the way. What happens to the conscience during all of this? When you say, well, no, you have to harden your heart. You have to scar your conscience over and convince yourself that you're okay even when you're not. And try to convince other people you're okay when they can see something's up, something's wrong. Something's very wrong. What is it? Well, so he indicates that the phase two faith of the believer is viewed as something that is valuable. And the testing of that is what really manifests what it is. Apart from testing, we can't see your faith. And then James talks about that. Show me your faith without your works. And I'll show you my faith by my works. He essentially argues you can't see faith, so don't run around talking about it. Show it. Demonstrate it. He includes a parenthetical comparison between the nature and value of gold, which has been refined by fire, and the nature and value of an imperishable faith. He concludes with a subjunctive verb which is designed to indicate that success under the testing of one's faith has some great eternal potential, but that it is not a foregone conclusion. And then K, the blessings that will come to those that succeed under the testing of their faith, which will initially be distributed at the Bema Seat, include: 1, praise. This will come in the form of verbal commendation for those that remained faithful under the testing of their faith. You may only hear 2 words. That'll be fine. Well done. I can live with that. I can live. If the Lord looks at me and says, well done, I'm good. He doesn't have to offer any more than that. That will be enough. Glory, this will result in an overt condition in which the adjusted believer will be seen in a glorious condition, sharing the appropriate measure of the glory of God. And how much glory does God have? We don't. It's infinite. That's another thing that's come across to me loud and clear in Ephesians. His grace is infinite. His patience, infinite. His love, infinite. His resources, infinite. His glory, infinite. His grace, infinite. You can't exhaust these things. So say, well, I don't want to get too much glory because God may not have enough to go around. Oh, he does. He won't run short. He's not going to say, whoops. All out. Those at the end of the line, sorry. All out of glory. That won't happen. And then honor, point 3, this can refer either to a position of honor. And some of the parables we see, be you in a position of authority over 10 cities. And that's a position of honor and authority and all of that. You be over 5 cities. You go away. And that's what he told the one worthless servant. It can be a position of honor or to the overt a regard and respect that he will receive from others. That's a form of honor that comes from other people. However, for others, there will be some shame. 1 John 2:28. Now, little children, and this means all of us, abide in him. Walk in fellowship as much as you can. Put him first. Occupation with Christ. That means putting doctrine first. So that when he appears, we may have confidence. Now, we may not. See, that's the potential here. We may have confidence. And not shrink away from him in shame at his coming. Is that really who you want to be at the end of it all? To have the Lord look at you and you shrink away in shame. Rather than well done, you get go away. Mm-hmm. I know that's not what I want. I mean, and again, how all this plays out is contingent upon what we do in time. This is all on us at the moment. Now, but obviously when I say it's all on us, God's got the grace to provide all that we need. He provides the supply and the measure of the Spirit, plenty of doctrine, all the resources, a spiritual gift, mercy and grace and knowledge and truth. We get all these things from God. So this is possible not to shrink away in shame from him. But there are a good number of believers that are probably going to do it. I just don't want to be among them. Okay, well, we're going to have to stop there today. This is our month to celebrate the Lord's table, so let's stop there and we'll get everything in order. Thank you, Father, for the opportunity to consider the matters of your word. We pray that you would strengthen us with regard to our faith. We do believe, help our unbelief, and help us to continue to grow in those things that result in a Christian life that is pleasing in your sight, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.